Thank you, Robert, Lord Mayor. I hope you're still the Lord Mayor tomorrow and for 4 years at least thereafter. Ladies and gentlemen, let me start by telling you a couple of stories, because I thought the notion of coming along and reading a speech to this gathering was not too smart. The first story is about the Wei Ling family. The Wei Ling family lived on the banks of the Yangtze River in China, and we come upon them one night, one afternoon, and Father Wei Ling has got his four kids lined up along the banks of the river, and he's saying to the four kids, "Which of you pushed the family's outhouse into the Yangtze River?" And no one's owning up. And finally, Father Wei Ling, in desperation, says, "Look, kids, let me tell you a story. Long ago, there was a guy called George Washington in a faraway country. In his case, his father came home and the cherry tree had been chopped down. And George Washington's father said to him, 'Look, son, it's all right. Just tell the truth. You won't get into trouble. As long as you own up and you're honest, there won't be any recriminations.' So George Washington owned up, and he always remembered how important it was to tell the truth. And children," said Father Wei Ling, "George Washington went on to become the first president of the United States." So kids, will you tell me which of you pushed the family dunny into the Yangtze River? So eventually the youngest kid put his hand tremulously up in the air and he said, "Dad, I want to be like George Washington. I'm going to tell the truth. I pushed the outhouse into the river." So his father picked up the nearest stick and he beat the whatever out of his youngest child. And as the kid was blubbering, he said, "Yes, but Dad, what about George Washington?" And he said, "Son, it's all a matter of perspective. You see, George Washington's father was not in the cherry tree." Now, hold the thought. That is not just a joke. Hold the thought about perspective. The other story which I thought was relevant to my remarks was, this is a joke I used to tell 20 and more years ago because it fits a speech any politician can make. The story is about the oldest profession in the world. And the story goes that there are three gentlemen, having a drink up at the Newcastle Club or wherever. And it's late at night and they've had a few drinks, and there's a doctor and there's a manager and there's a politician. And after a few drinks, the doctor says, "You know, I'm really proud of my profession. The medical profession is the oldest profession in the world." The other two thought about that, and the manager said, "Look, you know, that's not right, because I know my Old Testament. I know the book of Genesis. And before Adam was created out of Eve's rib, before there was medical work going on, someone created order out of chaos. That's what I do at my job every day as a manager. So clearly management's the oldest profession in the world." And it didn't take the politician long. He said, "Ah, yes. But who do you think created the chaos in the first place?" Now, I actually do think those two thoughts, the capacity of the body politic, and not just of one side, to create chaos, and the fact that all of these difficult issues are pretty much a matter of perspective, is very apposite to the question that I was asked to talk about. Now, I don't actually remember Susanna agreeing to speak about port and infrastructure bottlenecks in Newcastle. That sounds like a convenient sort of thing because of my recent short task for the state government, but I will say a bit about that in a minute. But look, my perspective is not of any sort of expert on logistics or ports. Probably I do know a little about infrastructure construction and financing, but I think my perspective is of someone who's looked at the state both from the government side and from the private sector side, and who really does worry about the quality and pace of decision-making in general in Australian government, but particularly in New South Wales. And, you know, CEDA is determinedly non-political, so I'm going to be mostly non-political, but it is the case that the pace of decision-making about planning issues like this is really glacially and unnecessarily slow. Look, I think Newcastle, I used to come up here a lot. Why did I come up here a lot as Premier? I came up here because at that time you had managed to break, the good people of Newcastle had broken the one-party monopoly on the Hunter. I was saying to Eileen at the table, and this is not a partisan comment, Newcastle and the Hunter will never, ever, ever be taken seriously while you maintain a single-party monopoly in state government. And it's simply factually true. And no one in their right mind, you could have voted Labor for 20 generations. It is impossible, impossible to believe that having a one-party monopoly of a region like this, with the track record that your members and the Labor governments have had, and there must be Labor governments in New South Wales history, until that breaks down, you won't get taken seriously. You don't get taken seriously, neither does the Illawarra. I wouldn't differentiate between the two. There's obvious similarities, and the truth is that it is an absolute sine qua non. I'm sure you don't speak a lot of Latin in the Hunter. It is an absolute prerequisite, in my opinion, that something a bit like what's happened in Western Australia, a sort of political movement that says we're going to put the region first. We're not going to be particularly, you know, liberal or Labor or, you know, right of centre or left of centre. We are going to be absolutely focused on doing the right thing for the region and seeing that the region gets its correct share of infrastructure spending from government and its correct share of government attention on policy and planning. I think a political force like that in both the Hunter and Illawarra is long overdue, and I think any objective observer would say that the regions have generally got attention, and it's happened in both the Hunter and the Illawarra over time, when for whatever political accident the sort of monopoly situation has usually briefly been broken down is when you get attention. I don't know the numbers, but if there isn't an infrastructure deficit in the Hunter, I'll eat my hat or jump off the gap out there. If Newcastle and the Hunter get their share of the state infrastructure budget, I will go do whatever. I don't know the numbers, but I am sure there is a massive imbalance between the population share and the infrastructure share. And I should have looked it up first or got someone to look it up for me, but I believe that's the case. Now, that said, and I will come to the subject in a sec, the Hunter has obviously done well over the last couple of decades. The Hunter's done better than the rest of the state by and large. It's diversified its economy. I think in many ways the best thing that's happened, by my observation, was the end of the steel industry, because it actually forced the diversification that's taken place. And there is no doubt that the efforts of public and private sector together have led to a healthy compared to the rest of New South Wales economy in the Hunter. I mean, that's partly God has helped a bit in that exercise. But it is obvious that the various organisations represented here, and perhaps some of them not, but the Business Chamber and the HEDC and the Research Foundation, you do have a lot of bodies up here, a lot of organisations. But by and large, I think it's obvious that they've done a good job. It's just my contention that it could clearly be done better, and it would be done better, frankly, if the government insisted that decisions were made. And I won't go on about the railway line down the road. It was an issue 20 years ago, the question of whether the railway line ought to run where it does. I thought 20 years ago it was absurd to develop Honeysuckle Bay, which I have to say was largely a work of my government, and keep the railway line there. It defies any common sense. But I can understand that other people have different views, but you've got to make a bloody decision and get on with it. And the same applies to the F3 extension. I mean, the late and lamented Frank Sartor, wonderful man, is, you know, proving thousands of houses out near Brankston, and yet the F3 continues not to go there, and you have sort of a mini road going there. I mean, these sort of things are not, you know, don't require any genius. They don't require anything except a will to actually make decisions and see that they're implemented. And I have to say my impression is that some of these decisions grind on. I think there are urban planning. If you drive through the main street of, perhaps I won't name all the towns in fairness, but I spend a fair bit of time in the direction of my money-losing vineyard at Broke, appropriately named, and there are a lot of towns in the Hunter which obviously have a desperate problem in terms of urban renewal, whether someone like Stocklander, which I'm deputy chairman's got a new shopping centre down the road and it's got the main street of Maitland sort of in trouble, whether it's Cessnock, Greta, Weston, you can go through them all, and parts of the Newcastle CBD, Lord Mayor, perfectly obviously got real urban planning issues. And they're not going to get better unless someone actually bites the bullet and comes up with a plan for what you're going to do with Cessnock, what you're going to do with the Maitland Main Street and so on. And there are no magic answers, but the answer can't be to leave things sort of as they are, which to my observation is the case in a fair number of instances around. So I think the Hunter has done well. I think it could do much better in terms of infrastructure and much better in terms of just a determined effort to solve what are obvious problems. Which brings me to the subject I was really asked to talk about, but you know, when you're an ex-politician, even if it's 20 years ago, you can't resist the temptation. I was called by Joe Tripodi on Christmas Eve. I don't often get calls from Joe Tripodi, you'll be surprised to hear. And he said, "Oh, mate..." And, you know, Bill Hayden said this, when the Labor Party calls you and says, "Mate, you know you're in trouble." He said, "Mate, I'd like you to come and see me. I've got a job I want you to do." He called me in and he briefed me about, I think with Gary, as it happens, with Gary Webb, about the issues of the coal companies not being able to reach a sort of conclusion of their own about short-term capacity balancing, as I discovered it was called. And that not much had happened in 2007 in terms of the companies reaching agreement, and he thought that it'd be a good idea if I facilitated the coal company CEOs getting together and helped them reach an agreement, not write a report in the conventional sense, but actually just facilitated an industry and the service providers to the industry facilitated some discussions leading the industry to come up with its own solution. So foolishly, I called back and said, "Okay, I'll do it on two conditions. One, I don't want to be paid, and two, I want it to be over in 3 months." Joe had no trouble accepting the "don't want to be paid" part, and Gary assured me it'd be over in 3 months. Joe was right, Gary was wrong, but there you go. So the process started, and look, it isn't new. Rand's Navy was out there when I was opposition leader in 1984. We came up on the Channel 10 helicopter and there were umpteen ships off Newcastle in 1984. So the general problem's not new. It is obvious that there's been a surge in the global demand for coal. Newcastle and the Hunter have got on the hinterland, sort of out to Gunnedah, has got high quality coal. So the demand for coal clearly got ahead of the infrastructure, got ahead of both rail and port infrastructure, and so there's a problem. I think it's fair to say that, you know, you had a lot of government involvement until not so long ago with the Joint Coal Board. You had sort of a confused private sector ownership or involvement of the coal companies in the ownership of some of the infrastructure. You had some of the coal companies with equity shares in Port Waratah, others without. And it was sort of a confused, sort of grew by historical accident. There was a common user clause. You know, anyone who turned up, if Nick turned up with his wheelbarrow of coal, Eileen and Graham Davidson had to load Nick's barrow of coal because it was sort of common user. And it sort of grew up that way. It was sort of halfway to a user cooperative, but not a fully fledged one. I think if it had been a fully fledged one and that had kept going, rather than the NCIG process, I think that might actually have been the optimal outcome, actually, a single producer-owned infrastructure company, in my view, might well have been optimal. But anyway, there was some history and the history of government involvement. But, of course, there hadn't been the situation of very high excess demand, very high coal prices that prevailed and is still prevailing. So my task was to help the coal companies decide on the short-term capacity allocation. That, of course, was not the right question, as we quickly worked out. The ACCC, and Robert read the quote, helped us. They said, we're really not interested in how you divide up 2009 or 2008, which by then was already happening, because frankly, it matters to individual companies, but it doesn't really matter to the state how you divide up the inadequate amount of capacity that's there. The real question in public policy terms is, if there's demand for 130 or 150 or whatever million tonnes, how can you make sure that there is capacity to deliver that rather than delivering 20, 30 or 40% less than the effective demand? So the ACCC gave us some help with this, and frankly, at the very first meeting, the coal companies had no trouble agreeing to the notion that you did need to get the long-term economic principles right for the Hunter, and if you did that, you could probably work out the short-term. And whilst you might have different points of view at the margin, the real issue was getting the right economic principles to govern the provision of both loader and rail infrastructure for the Hunter. And with Michael Dowser's help, who's here somewhere who works for Gary, we sort of facilitated a process. We probably helped a little at the edges. And not in 3 months, but in 5 months, the coal companies did reach an agreement. We bullied them a bit on the way because we told them that if they didn't reach their own agreement, we'd come up with our own version, and we figured correctly that they probably wouldn't like that. And they're right. I mean, you don't want the government, any government, even nice people like myself or Michael, you don't want the government mandating the outcome if it's in fact an industry issue and in fact the industry is funding the provision of the infrastructure. Why would you want to pass responsibility over to a government or an external person? There's really no reason. Now, the industry came up with an answer. They effectively said, look, we accept that the coal chain is a coal chain. We accept that there ought to be more than the existing logistics team, which does a good job in terms of helping run the coal chain at the moment, but the coal companies were not inside the coal chain, they were outside. And it was a bit of a ping-pong game. The logistics team says, here's a plan for a day or 5 days or a month, and then the coal companies would bat it back, and not surprisingly, you don't in fact get anywhere near the optimal outcome. And everyone agreed that, so you do need a beefed-up version of the Hunter Valley coal logistics team, which I think we called, or they called, the coal chain coordinator. And we all decided it needed to have some grunt and some independence, and that that was a prerequisite to actually running the chain as a whole and maximising its throughput. I am told that there may be some backsliding from some coal companies. And incidentally, I've had nothing to do with any of this since the end of June, so I have no current knowledge. There's a number of people in the room who do. I don't know the current state of all this. I'm told there may be some backsliding. I think that'd be a great pity, because common sense says that you need a coordinator. I mean, in Queensland, they call it, they've got a formal title, and the government sort of mandates that someone shall be the coordinator because the government is more actively involved in the chain than here. I think that's sort of fundamental. So the first thing is you have to accept that it is a chain. It's not a loader and some rail capacity and some loading points. It is a chain, and the name of the game from the public interest point of view is maximising the overall throughput rather than playing around with bits and pieces. As part of that, you also have to share information. I did say to the coal companies in this room, actually, I've been involved in lots of industries over the last 25 years. Coal industry is the most hopelessly secretive of any industry I've seen, and that doesn't help. And the big companies, the BHPs and so on, are the more secretive. And they've got legal opinions and things that tell you, you know, you can't do this, you can't do that, or you've got concerns with competition policy. I don't actually accept that that's right. You can't run a multi-user thing with 14, I think it's 14 now, coal companies. You can't run it efficiently if no one has the willingness to provide information into a black box, not to each other, but into a black box so that you can run, you can maximise the overall situation. If you're not prepared to provide the necessary information, then you may all go home because you clearly won't be able to optimise the outcome. So I do hope that the cold chain coordinator does come to pass and does have a reasonable amount of grunt and a reasonable amount of independence. Secondly, and I guess this is sort of the point that gets the publicity, the coal companies told Michael Dowser and I that these were their hand-on-heart numbers for which they would be prepared to enter take-or-pay contracts for the next 10 years. And they came up with numbers that were in excess of 200 million tonnes this year, and Graham will tell me, or Elaine, that they're sort of 95 million or whatever the number is going through the port this year. So the coal company said, we are prepared to put our wallets on the line that that there will be a need to double the capacity of the Hunter Valley coal chain, plus a bit, but let's just say double for the sake of the argument, over the next 5 years. But everyone agreed to that general proposition. They all agreed to the numbers. They basically all told us that their numbers were right. They weren't so sure about the other people's numbers. But nevertheless, the overall conclusion, I think, was genuinely accepted that there is a clear, long-term, fundable need to double, plus some, the capacity of the loader and, of course, of the rail leading to the loader. And everyone agreed that the way to fund this was with take-or-pay contracts, basically 10 years and rolling. And we all agreed that if we could all get that agreed, then you could deal with the transition. In other words, what happens until the capacity is built. And I don't know that we need to go into great detail because some of you know more about it than I do and others of you may be bored, but broadly speaking, Port Waratah, which is the long-standing existing loader, has plans and said it would go to 145 million tonnes, and NCIG, which is building stage one at the moment, which won the government's tender a couple of years ago for the right to build a new loader, said it would do its second stage, which would make it 66 million tonnes, which happens to add up to 211 million tonnes per annum capacity. But I don't think one should get hung up on the absolute precision of those numbers, but you would broadly have more than 200 million tonnes of capacity. And the coal companies effectively are going to fund this by take-or-pay contracts. There is no need for government financial involvement. There's obvious need for government to make appropriate planning decisions, provide land and so on, but there's no direct government involvement in terms of funding or operation. And the third element of the bottleneck was obviously the rail part, which I think a lot of the coal companies actually believe is the crucial part of the chain. The question is, how many minutes is that you're telling me? Five, thank you. Can't shut politicians up, do you? The notion, obviously, is there's no point having 200 plus million tonnes at the loader if you can't get coal there along the rail network. And pretty much the same conclusions were reached, that the coal companies would enter into long-term take-or-pay contracts with the ARTC, with Denise down here, which would enable the ARTC, which is a federal government-owned instrumentality, to fund this, but to fund it effectively through a special purpose vehicle so that it also could make a proper return, as it ought to and as it should, and that it could fund, in terms of the SPV funding through debt, the cost of the rail infrastructure. And I think Denise is speaking tomorrow, but there are access undertakings out there, I think, between ARTC and the coal companies. So the industry came up with an answer. I think it was essentially a good answer. The minister, when I sent him, really, I just flicked past, handballed the, depend which code, I just gave him what the industry had decided, because it wasn't my task or the Port of Newcastle's task to get the right answer. It was our task to get the industry to reach an answer. The minister was broadly happy, except he was worried about new entrants because the existing 14 companies had come up with a resolution and it didn't have explicit provision for new entrants. And it's fair to say that, that Joe was pretty focused on this. As far as I know, he's still focused on it, and it's 3 months later. To be honest, I think this is all a little unbelievable. There is a legitimate question about what happens if the government allows someone to develop a new mine. They obviously aren't going to develop a new mine unless they can get their coal out of the port. So it is a legitimate, but I have to say marginal, question as to what happens to new entrants. And I did say to him, Minister, look, you're right, there isn't anything about new entrants. Why don't you go back to the coal companies and say, coal companies, I need some explicit understanding of what will happen if there is, in fact, a new entrant. And they will manage, this won't be a total shock to them, and they will manage, I suspect, to come up with an answer that will be satisfactory. What they won't do, I imagine, is come up with an answer that is the present mindset, present as in today and going backwards, which is there isn't enough capacity, so if someone new comes along, we've got to compress everyone who's already there. Because that's obviously achieving nothing in terms of the hunter or the state. Simply cutting the pie up a different way isn't the name of the game. The name of the game is ensuring that the pie, that is the chain capacity, loader and rail, is able, with reasonable lead times, is able to be built ahead of what is needed. That's the objective, not to go back to the mindset that says, well, let's have a fight about how we can spread it out, and if someone comes along with 5 or 10 million tonnes in a new mine, well, we'll just reduce all the existing ones. That is sort of the mindset that's been around, and it's precisely, I think, the root of the problem. So I had this discussion with the minister, and I haven't had one since, and the coal companies and William or someone will know what's happening, I suspect. I don't, but I understand there is ongoing discussion with the minister and the coal companies about how to deal with new entrants. Can I just tell you that if I was sort of representing the people of New South Wales, if I could get the coal companies to fund 200 million tonnes or more of capacity, both through ARTC, through the rail, and through the loader, I would reckon things were pretty damn good. They would be extraordinarily better off, the people of New South Wales, as well as all the individual stakeholders, if that capacity was built. And especially if the Hunter Valley Coal Chain Coordinator existed, you would have a proper protocol so that if a new person came along and they gave you a couple of years' notice. I mean, this happens all over the world. It's not as though Newcastle's one-off with this problem. It is a problem all over the world. What do you do with new or additional? It doesn't have to be new entrants. It can be existing people with new additional needs. You have to have a protocol as to how you expand the capacity. I did say, and I need to say this to you because the papers are going to report it, I did say to the papers that if Joe spent less time sending horses' heads to his political opponents and more time just telling the coal companies to give him what he needs, then there wouldn't be a problem. And the fact that it's taken 3 months, it took the coal companies, and there's 14 of them, and it is like herding cats, it didn't take them much more than 3 months to resolve this package. It's now taken almost the same time to actually get something happening because of this thing about new entrants. And there is just no excuse in God's earth for that happening. It is the ultimate example of the tail wagging the dog. It's just stupid. I think that's really as much as I wanted to say, and I think I might have exceeded my time, but in my view, if the government expedites the approvals, the lease changes, ensures the availability of land, that's all the government needs to do. I'll finish on this note. I think Minister Tripodi had a stunning insight on Christmas Eve. He said, look, this is a problem for the industry. The industry should be able to resolve it. And he was exactly right. And the industry's gone at least 95% of the way there. and he should be able to get them to go to 100%, because otherwise Christmas Eve will come again this year. I won't be taking any calls from Joe, especially after what I've just said. And I won't be here for the horse's head. But the ACCC, I'm sure, does not want to spend Christmas holidays this year determining another short-term outcome for the Hunter Valley Coal Companies. It wants, ahead of that time, to have a long-term package, as I've very briefly sketched, and a short-term, you know, transitional path that gets you from here to there. That's what should happen. So thank you for the opportunity of being here tonight, and I do hope the Hunter goes on to even bigger and better things. Thank you.